All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Please be seated. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court, sitting in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho for our third and final hearing on September 18, 2024. This matter is entitled Streamline Builders LLC versus Chase. It is case number 50953. In this matter, the appellant is Stephen Chase, represented by Wendy Olson, and the respondent Streamline Builders LLC and Richard Sobota, represented by Jason Wing. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters?
Well, on behalf of Mr. Chase, no, sir.
Nothing, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just note that Justice Myers recused in this case, and we're pleased to have District Judge Michelle Evans sitting pro tem with the court to participate fully in the entire proceeding. With that, Ms. Olson, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Wing, good morning. The evidence presented at trial showed that third-party defendant Stephen Chase, the appellant here, acted at the request and direction of his mother, Audrey Chase, to assist her in the real estate transaction and the building of her home by Richard Sobota and Streamline Builders. Indeed, he was involved in the transaction only because his mother asked him to be. Thus, under Idaho law, he was not a stranger to the contract or to the economic expectation. And the contract provided the only economic expectation that Mr. Sobota and Streamline Builders had. Thus, under Idaho law, Mr. Chase could not wrongfully interfere with that contract. He was his mother's agent. The trial court erred in determining otherwise when it denied Mr. Chase's motion for a directed verdict. On the record before the trial court, and under the standard both the trial court and this court must apply, there was not sufficient evidence at trial to make a contrary determination. That Steve was acting as his mother Audrey's personal agent and exercising both actual and apparent authority in acting on her behalf was not disputed by any party. Indeed, the trial court recognized as much in ruling on Mr. Chase's motion for a directed verdict, explaining that Stephen was acting on Ms. Chase's behalf and that whatever Mr. Chase did was being directed by Ms. Chase with regards to his involvement in the events leading up to the closing. Indeed, at no point did Mr. Sobota or Streamline dispute that Stephen was acting on his mother's behalf in the transaction. Rather, Mr. Sobota himself testified at trial that he knew Audrey's family members were going to Audrey, and he knew her family members were helping her. Thus, Mr. Chase asks this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court and remand with instructions to enter judgment on Mr. Chase's behalf.
Ms. Olson, my struggle with the argument on the directed verdict is the jury found him liable. And so I'm struggling with how you can step past the jury verdict and say we're going to back up. And the essence of directed verdict is there's not enough evidence to present this to the jury. But clearly there was, because they found him liable. So help me understand how we ever get to the denial of your client's motion.
Yes, and I think the answer there is that's why it's important for the judge at the directed verdict stage to make an appropriate determination based on the evidence and the law, because it is the case that sometimes juries make decisions that are at odds with that.
And so why not file a motion for JNOB then?
Well, Your Honor, because we decided to file a appeal the decision of the district court rather than file a motion for JNOB. I understand the court's position, but that's not the approach that our client elected to take.
And so where the jury found him liable, where did the jury go wrong? Because I'm looking at the instruction that the parties agreed to give, instruction 59, on the elements of tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, and I don't see any element in here that relates to the agency arguments you're making on appeal.
It does include an instruction with respect to wrongful. And when you look at what wrongful means under Idaho law, there is clear Idaho law with both respect to the Becco case that we've cited in our brief and with respect to the city of Boise, or the Cantwell versus City of Boise case we cite in our brief. And where there is a relationship where one is acting on behalf of the other, whether you call it agency or in the case of Cantwell and other cases that they cite, including Leon versus Boise State University, where we're looking at people who were employees, and we don't necessarily call them agents, but they were employees of the entity that they're acting on behalf of, then this court, this state's law, is that that interference cannot be wrongful. And when the court at the directed verdict stage is presented with an argument that because Mr. Chase was acting on his mother's behalf and at her direction, under the law, there cannot be a finding that that interference, if interference occurred, was wrongful. And so that's why it was important for the court at the directed verdict stage to make that important determination that under the law, there was not sufficient evidence to send that to the jury.
I understand your argument that the judge sometimes serves as a barrier between the passions of the jury. I appreciate that argument. I think that is an important role. But one of the instructions we give to the jury in every trial we have in Idaho is that the jury gets to decide what evidence to believe, what witnesses to believe, what testimony to give weight to, what testimony to give no weight to. Doesn't the judge, when he gets a motion for a directed, he or she gets a motion for a directed verdict, don't they have that same prerogative that the jury has to weigh the evidence, to determine which witnesses the judge believes is credible or not credible, and determine which testimony they're going to believe or not believe, just like the jury does?
Well, I think it's not quite the same, Your Honor. I think the standard is a little different. Quite frankly, it's more differential to the non-moving
party. So what is that
standard? So this, the standards is that we set out in our brief that set out in Drug Testing Compliance Group, LLC versus DOT Compliance Service. It's that whether there was sufficient evidence to justify submitting the claim to the jury, viewing as true all adverse evidence, and drawing every legitimate inference in favor of the party opposing the motion for a directed verdict. This test does not require the evidence be uncontradicted, but only that it be of sufficient quantity and probative value that reasonable minds could conclude that a verdict in favor of the party against whom the motion made is proper.
So what you're suggesting is the judge's position on a motion for a directed verdict is really not that different than the judge's position at summary judgment?
Correct, Your Honor.
All inferences towards the non-moving party.
Correct, Your Honor. I think they're phrased a little bit differently, and it may even be the City of Cantwell case that talks about the slight differences in that. But I think, Your Honor, under that standard, that is where the trial court erred. And I think when one looks at even the very conclusory finding, and I think it was a finding, that the trial court made during the argument for directed verdict, shows that error. The trial court said that there was the evidence that Mr. Chase was acting on his mother's behalf and that he was acting at her direction.
So normally at summary judgment, we instruct judges not to weigh credibility. But in a trial, isn't it different? Is it error for a judge to say, you know what, I want to hear all the evidence before I decide credibility? I want to hear all the evidence before I decide whether I believe them or not? I mean, just like we expect a jury to do?
Well, I think the judge had done that, Your Honor. I think at the time that the directed verdict motions were presented, he had heard all of that testimony. And I think, Your Honor, where the trial court erred, and there were several motions being heard for directed verdict, there were not detailed references by the court to any particular part of the evidence that the trial court had heard. And so I think now on this appeal, this court, because of the standard of review, applies that exact same standard. And so this court looks at the evidence and determines whether or not there was sufficient evidence that it should have gone past the directed verdict phase. And our argument is it did not, because the evidence that was in the record showed that at all times, Mr. Chase was acting at his mother's direction and that she had asked him to do that.
If this case had procedurally followed the process outlined in Christensen, in which you had a motion for a directed verdict followed then by a timely JNOV, wouldn't the judge be able to look at that and conclude that the evidence presented, a reasonable jury might not have believed this witness? I mean, doesn't the judge get to factor credibility at all when they're making a decision in a JNOV situation?
Well, Your Honor, even if the judge does get to make a credibility determination in a JNOV situation, there was nothing here to suggest that it was a credibility issue, that there was a significant credibility issue in looking at and weighing the evidence. The evidence was, respectfully, undisputed that Mr. Chase was acting on his mother's behalf. And there are some citations, I think it's at pages 17 to 19 of our opening brief, where we cite all the points in the record, or many of the points in the record, where everyone understood that Mr. Chase was acting at his mother's behalf, on his mother's behalf. And there is not a single supportable citation to the record by Mr. Swoboda that shows otherwise. And I would say that's specifically true with respect to conduct after the failed closing, which is, of course, also after the economic expectation had expired. Nonetheless, after that failed closing, Mr. Chase was expressly put in charge of the negotiations with anything having to do with the building contract and the resolution of that. That evidence was undisputed. There is not a single piece of evidence in the record to show that after August 22nd of 2018, that anyone other than Mr. Chase was authorized to act on behalf of Audrey Chase. Now, there are some arguments that Mr. Swoboda and Streamline make in their response that there were some tactics that Mr. Chase took that were not the kind of tactics that they believe Mr. Chase should have taken. But that doesn't mean that he was not acting at his mother on his mother's behalf. And that, of course, is after the economic expectation has extinguished. And then if we look at the evidence of what he did prior to the time that failed closing occurred, well, Your Honor, I don't see any evidence that they've cited either that he was not acting at his mother's direction. There is evidence that at certain times, Audrey Chase was able to do some reading and was able to interact with Mr. Swoboda and to go to the construction site. I don't think that means anything with respect to whether or not Mr. Chase was acting on her behalf or assisting her when he did so. There is evidence in the record that at all times, Mr. Chase was the conduit through which communications flowed, particularly with respect to email communications.
There was one instance in the record, I think, had to do with the carpet in the bedroom floor, where it sounds like Audrey had a preference that was disregarded by her son. Does that tell us anything?
Well, Your Honor, that was testimony. It does not. That was testimony from Mr. Swoboda. It's testimony in the part of the record that talks about the punch list, where Mr. Swoboda also asserts that the punch list was not Audrey's punch list. But if you look at the actual transcript as to that part of the trial, and that is at if you look at page 7 of the responsive briefing, and it talks about all of that and refers to this erroneous punch list and demands related to that, including the laminate flooring, Mr. Swoboda himself testified at 1575 line 15 to 1576 line 8 that Audrey had approved that punch list and she knew about it. So that's the testimony that Mr. Swoboda gave. So there's simply not testimony that there simply isn't evidence that Mr. Chase was acting outside the scope of Audrey's authority. And most significantly, with respect to that, It's unclear to me how the conduct, and when you look at whether they're acting as an agent, you look at whether or not the actual, and it is outside the scope, you look at whether the conduct complained of is outside the scope and then has the impact that they say it's going to have. Well, even if Mr. Chase disagreed with what his mother said about the laminate flooring, and to be clear, the evidence is also in the record that the contract required laminate flooring in the room. That's what the contract said. So that's also the evidence that's in the record. But there's also no reason to think that whether at one point Aubrey said something about laminate versus carpet in that bedroom, that that had any impact on whether or not the contract failed. So when you talk about was he acting within the scope of his agency and was he acting at her direction as we move toward the closing, which is where the economic expectancy was to culminate, that fact has no bearing on that. They made it to the closing. So when things were being done by Mr. Chase on behalf of his mother throughout the entire time up to August 22nd of 2018, there is no evidence that anything he did outside the agency was outside the scope of that agency relationship and had an impact on the closing.
Then how did the jury find them liable? I mean, I'm sorry, I'm still stuck where I was at the beginning, which is you're not saying the jury got it wrong. The jury found him liable. How was there not enough evidence to submit it to them if they found him liable and you're not saying they were wrong?
Well, not that we did not raise that issue on appeal, Your Honor, that is correct. Juries, I've been a trial lawyer for 32 years. Juries do funny things. And I had a conversation with Mike Ramson at the bar meeting after the trial. He was one of the counsel on the other side, and we discussed that sometimes juries just have a gestalt about what should happen and who should be responsible. And so I think it's hard to explain why the jury did what they did. It is puzzling. The court has certainly seen from some of the communications that Mr. Chase had that he has a challenging communication style at times. That doesn't mean that he wasn't acting on his mother's behalf. That doesn't mean that he was acting outside the scope of the authority that she gave him. In fact, she knew those things and put him absolutely in charge after the closing failed.
And I understand your argument, but mine is more of a procedural hang-up, which is how can you say I'm not going to fight the jury verdict and at the same time say there wasn't enough to give it to the jury? I mean, they just seem incompatible to me, and so I struggle with how you can pick off the directed verdict but not attack the jury verdict against your client because the one seems to disprove the other.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that failing to raise one issue on appeal doesn't mean that the other one is a valid issue. I think that under the law, on the directed verdict stage, the court had a standard it was to follow, the trial court, the same standard this court has to follow. And I don't think there is any requirement that in order to challenge a judge's ruling on a directed verdict, that you also have to have brought a motion for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Although I appreciate that that may have been a strategy that Mr. Chase should have pursued on appeal. He did not. I think the court's that it is proper to challenge the directed verdict. There's a standard of review for this court. I think it is proper under Idaho case law for the court to consider the new authority that is provided with respect to the specific agency argument. I think that this court's decisions in State versus Gonzalez and the Ada County Highway District versus Bellevue and State versus, I think it's Rodriguez-Garcia, those names might be in reverse, amply illustrate or amply provide authority for Mr. Chase to raise this argument. It's the same argument that he made throughout, which is that I was acting at all times on my mother's behalf. I was acting at her direction. Our interests were aligned, so I am not a stranger to the contract. And under this court's law, if you're not a stranger to the contract, then there can be no wrongful interference. And we're asking this court to reverse the decision that the trial court made at the directed verdict stage.
I guess my struggle is you're invalidating, this attack invalidates the jury's verdict without alleging the jury did anything wrong. And I struggled with that. Setting aside the fact that juries may do things for different reasons, without directly attacking the jury's verdict, I don't know.
Where does Chase first argue that there was no wrongful interference? I mean, I looked at the jury instructions. I didn't see a wrongful instruction from your side. So where does it first get argued?
I think it first gets set out, as we put out in pages 3 to 5 of our reply brief, in the affirmative defenses. And in the affirmative defense, it said respondents' claims and requests for relief are barred because any actions taken by Mr. Chase were intended to assist his mother. And then the argument was made in our first motion for summary judgment and in our second motion for summary judgment. In the first motion for summary judgment, we specifically argued that they could not establish that any interference by Mr. Chase was wrongful. And that is precisely when the court looks at Cantwell versus City of Boise, that is precisely the basis that the court gave for determining that the interference was not, or that there was not intentional interference with prospective economic advantage claim. It was because the city employees who took action, who Cantwell sued, were at all times acting on behalf of the city. And where that occurs, interference cannot be wrongful. So Mr. Chase absolutely made that argument. And I think I'm into my rebuttal time, and unless there are other questions, I'll be happy to answer anything more right now, but we'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Just one question I'd like you to address so the other side can respond to it. Is a denial of a motion for a directed verdict an appealable decision? I know it's not listed under Idaho Appellate Rule 11 among the appealable orders of the court. I understand in a few cases we may have allowed it in the past, but is it an appealable order? Because it's kind of akin to a motion for summary judgment, and a denial of summary judgment is not appealable.
Yeah, I think it is, Your Honor, for the reason that, precise reason that this court has allowed such appeals before. And we try to follow the orders of that case law of this court, Your Honor.
You follow our bad practice, even if it's bad practice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wayne, when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Wing. I represent Streamline Builders LLC and Richard Svoboda. After more than 4 years of litigation and nine-day jury trial, the trial transcript and record in this matter is somewhat voluminous. However, the issue presented on appeal is very narrow. I would like to start by revisiting the issue presented on appeal as contained in the appellant's opening brief. That is, whether the trial court erred by denying Stephen Chase's motion for directed verdict on Streamline and Mr. Svoboda's claim for intentional interference with prospective economic advantage, despite finding that Stephen was at all times acting on behalf of and at the direction of his mother, Audrey, the party to the contract, giving rise to Streamline and Mr. Svoboda's prospective economic advantage. Stated another way, the appellant argues the denial of his motion for directed verdict was an error because the court allegedly made a finding of fact that Stephen Chase was at all times acting as his mother's agent. This appeal is therefore premised on the trial court making a finding of fact, and I would suggest to the court that no such finding of fact was ever made by the trial court. In this particular case, the trial court certainly recounted some of the testimony that was provided in this case and then proceeded to indicate that there's conflicting evidence in the matter and decided to submit the matter to the jury. I'd like to revisit some of the, I'm sure the court is familiar with the history of this case and with some of the factual background, but there's a couple matters I'd like to highlight. And that is that Audrey Chase, she signs this purchase and sale agreement with Streamline Builders in March of 2018. At that time the home was being constructed, Audrey lived only a few blocks away. So she would walk down to the job site almost every day. She would visit with Mr. Svoboda. Audrey was therefore able to communicate with him on a regular basis. And while Audrey Chase was beginning to suffer from macular degeneration in 2018, and looked to the assistance of her whole family, she was at that time able to review the purchase and sale agreement she signed without assistance. However, there was also testimony that she could not see a computer screen clearly, and so family members relayed electronic communications to her. However, at trial, Audrey did not recall at trial if Stephen Chase transmitted emails on her behalf during the time the subject home was being constructed. Despite her inability to recall whether emails had been transmitted on her behalf by her son Stephen Chase, of course, we have a treasure trove of email communications that were transmitted by Mr. Chase during the course of the construction and after the transaction failed to close. Those communications, to complicate matters, were transmitted from his personal email account, from his work email account, from Audrey's account, were sometimes signed by Audrey, were sometimes signed by Stephen Chase. Sometimes they contained a style and a tense that clearly suggests she's dictating to him, and then many of them do not. They do not have the same style and tense that would suggest that he is dictating communications. In other words, that they're coming from him. They're not coming from Audrey Chase. And Ms. Chase's and Stephen Chase's communications to the parties in this case were not always consistent with Ms. Chase's desires. And I'll give you a few examples. On July 19th of 2018, Audrey Chase executed addendum number 5 extending the closing date to August 17th, 2018. Simultaneously, while Audrey Chase is signing an addendum extending the closing date, Stephen Chase is sending an email out saying, "We're not extending." In late July of 2018, Stephen Chase began to express particular animus toward Streamline Builders and Mr. Svoboda. And on July 16th, almost a month before closing, and I think this is an important point, this is a month before closing, Mr. Chase sends an email to Stephen Smith, who was Mrs. Chase's realtor, an inflammatory email. It's in the record. It's been briefed. But Mr. Chase was pressed on his intent behind that inflammatory email, which accused Mr. Svoboda, Mr. Svoboda's realtor, and Mr. Smith of misconduct. And Mr. Chase was pressed on his intent, what he intended to do a month before closing. And what he said was exactly what we're doing now. And when he said that was in deposition, he was pressed by it in his deposition testimony at trial. In deposition, he said, "I intended then, in July of 2018, to do what I'm doing right now, which is the protracted litigation that we've been fighting since 2018. After the August 22nd, 2018 transaction failed to close, Audrey Chase's daughter-in-law, Iva Hawkins, sent an email to Audrey's realtor representing that at that time, now Stephen Chase is in charge and is speaking for her. That's the first time that that happened. After the transaction failed to close, it was communicated to the parties that Stephen Chase is now communicating on Audrey's behalf. Audrey's intent in granting Stephen Chase authority at that point in time, in August of 2018, was to reconcile the failed transaction. However, despite her stated intent that the transaction be reconciled, Mr. Chase proceeded to threaten to, quote, take Streamline Builders to the cleaners, threatened that the house will be in litigation for at least a year, that he is proceeding with a complaint with the licensing board and criminal complaints, and that the transaction was no longer going to close pursuant to the terms of the contract. It's hard to encapsulate 4 years of litigation into a few facts, especially when you have many parties involved in this case, but it gives just a slight flavor of what the jury heard over those 8 days of testimony. And I think it's important to point out that the jury didn't just award Mr. Svoboda $20,000. The jury tried to make Mr. Svoboda whole And if you look at the jury verdict at Section 11, the jury, in fact, tried to award Mr. Svoboda all of his legal fees. Of course, the jury didn't have the authority to do that. And we, of course, did not seek to enforce that portion of the judgment. But clearly, after 8 days of trial, the jury saw that Mr. Chase's conduct was so wrongful that they wanted to make him whole. They tried to make him whole. The single issue on appeal in this case is whether the court made a finding of fact. And that's merely pulled from the issues presented on appeal that's contained on page 10 of the appellant's brief. In page 1 of the appellant's brief, under the nature of the case, the same thing. It's described as this appeal is based on the court having made a finding. The court simply did not make a finding. It simply recited some of the testimony, followed that up with an expression that there is conflicting evidence, and presented the matter to the appeal. Mr. Chase has not argued his motion for directed verdict and did not argue or did not establish that he was the agent for Audrey Chase. It's important for us to remember that agency is not presumed. The party claiming it has the burden of proving both, one, that an agency relationship exists between the principal and the agent, and the scope of that. What is the scope of Mr. Chase's agency relationship? There's no argument of that in the motion for directed verdict. There was not arguments of that in the two motions for summary judgment that were filed the years leading up to the trial in this case. Mr. Chase did not meet his burden of establishing, one, the existence of an agency relationship, and that what the scope of that agency relationship even was. Merely the act of assisting somebody does not create an agency relationship. And it appears, looking back on the motions for summary judgment, on the trial brief, the arguments made in support of the motion for directed verdict, that Stephen Chase avoided the use of principal and agent, avoided the use of that argument. And I can only presume that's because the existence of an agency can be used as an offensive means to hold the principal liable. And perhaps they had tried to avoid that throughout the course of the litigation to try to prevent there being liability being found on the part of Audrey Chase because of what Stephen Chase did. But the record is devoid of the use of agency or principal in the context of describing the relationship between Audrey Chase and Stephen Chase.
So help me understand one more time why you think that there was a calculated move to avoid that label.
Well, because a principal can be held liable for...
I understand that.
Yeah.
Not so much that it might be, but what's the evidence in the record? What are you basing the assertion that occurred in this case, that there was a calculated move?
It's purely on the fact that there is no argument that he was the agent. The argument that has repeatedly been made, back in motion for summary judgment, for a directed verdict, is addressing the fourth element of the claim of tortious interference with prospective economic advantage. The fourth element of that claim requires there a showing of wrongful interference.
But my point, when I read some of the district court's decisions in this case, on, for example, the motion for summary judgment, when I look at the trial briefing, sometimes there's a discussion of the wrongful element of this claim, and sometimes there isn't. That is, sometimes it's described as a four-pronged test, sometimes a five-pronged test. And so I just look at it as, did people lose sight of what the law is in this area?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because there's two tortious claims. One's tortious interference with contract. That's a four-pronged test. There's tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, and that's a five-pronged test. They are separate causes of action. They do have separate elements to them. And in our trial brief, we brief them separately, separate sections, separate authority, separate elements of the claims. And in this particular case, whenever there's any discussion by Mr. Chase trying to eliminate the claim for tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, it's always attacking the wrongful interference. And the justification or the argument used is that, well, I was just assisting my mother. However, that's arguing that there wasn't wrongful intent. You can prove wrongful interference by wrongful intent or wrongful purpose. In this case, wrongful purpose is not so much relevant. That would be somebody who's pursuing their business and competing and just happens to be competing with somebody else. In this particular case, wrongful interference is what Stephen Chase tried to argue. He didn't have a wrongful intent in interfering. And by arguing that, he's saying, well, I'm just trying to help my mother. I didn't have a wrongful intent. He's arguing, I guess you could say, I have benevolent intent as opposed to wrongful intent. But arguing that he had benevolent intent in assisting his mother is not the same thing as arguing that he was his mother's agent, that there was an agent principal relationship there. You know, there was the analogy used in the appellant's reply brief about the groomed horse, which I thought was clever. But the horse that's being ridden into this chamber now, today, on appeal, is not an agency argument, or it is an agency argument. It's being argued that there is a principal-agent relationship. However, the horse that was ridden on the first motion for summary judgment, the second motion for summary judgment, in the trial brief and in arguments for a directed verdict relate to the fourth element of a claim for tortious interference with prospective economic advantage and argues about wrongful intent. And if we look at the trial transcript at page 288, and I'm looking at lines 17 through 19, Mr. George, who was counsel for Mr. Chase at that time, argues that Mr. Chase has to have an improper objective or purpose to harm the plaintiff. And he's attacking that element, saying that you can't prove interference with prospective economic advantage because I didn't have a wrongful intent. He didn't argue anywhere. It's never been argued until this appeal that an agent can't be liable for tortiously interfering with their principal's contract. This is the first time it's been argued on appeal. No authority was cited to the district court. And I think it's also important to point out that if Mr. Chase, well, first, on a motion for directed verdict, if there was an argument that was in the mind of Mr. Chase at the time he was moving for a directed verdict, he would have strenuously advocated for the fact that he's an agent, Ms. Chase is the principal, and that he can't be held liable because he was within the scope of his agency. That argument was not made. When the court denied that motion for a directed verdict, there was no attempt to offer a jury instruction describing the relationship between Audrey Chase and Stephen Chase as a principal-agent relationship. And I'll point out, we did. Jury instruction number 24 specifically describes the relationship between Streamline Builders LLC and Richard Sabota as an agency relationship. And Mr. Chase certainly could have done the same thing if he believed that was an undisputed fact. That wasn't done. There also wasn't a jury instruction describing the defense to the claim for tortious interference with prospective economic advantage. And again, I believe that's because it hadn't been argued before. It hadn't been argued prior to this appeal. And in fact, there was a conscious effort to avoid creating the appearance of an agency relationship because of the blowback it might have for the principal, Audrey Chase. And Justices, I think the authority in Caldwell and Beko Construction is relatively clear. To the extent that there isn't a dispute that an agency relationship exists, and in each of those cases, it wasn't in dispute. In Caldwell, you're dealing with city employees, and in Beko Construction, you're dealing with a principal-agent relationship that was defined by a contract, and the contract specifically described the scope of that relationship. We don't have that here. Again, the burden is on the person claiming the relationship to establish it first. The burden is on the person claiming the relationship to prove the scope of that relationship, and neither of those things happened in this particular case. Unless the court has any more questions, I don't know that I have anything to add.
Is there no questions?
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
9 minutes.
Ms. Olson?
Thank you. And I think perhaps I'll start with close to the point where Mr. Wing left off, and that's on this question of whether the agency argument is one that was raised below. And I would love to take credit for the wonderful analogy, but that was Justice Brody in State versus Gonzalez. And I think if this court goes back to that opinion, and that is the one where the court really lays out how it looks at these issues. As I mentioned in my opening comments, it's a 2019 decision. It looks back at the two 2017 decisions, State versus Garcia Rodriguez, and Ada County Highway District versus Bokku. And the question really is, was the substantive issue below the same as the substantive issue being raised in the appeal? Even if the legal arguments made on appeal are better and more refined. And I think here, of those three cases, the one that is most on point is Ada County Highway District versus Brookview. And in that case, Ada County Highway District below had always said, look, we don't think you can get construction damages as part of your just compensation in a taking. And by the time they got to this court, Ada County Highway District also cited two statutes that said that exact same thing. Well, that is what Mr. Chase is doing here.
Well, I think it's a little more refined in Brookview. The issue was a statute of limitations. The issue, you have to identify the issue and you have to take a position. And in Ada County, the state had always argued that there was a statute of limitations problem with the claim. Other issues too, but statute of limitations was always at play. And what they did on appeal was they finally got around to citing the statute that laid out the statute of limitations. And my problem is, like, when I look at the trial brief here, it seems like, I understand your position that you're saying he was always acting on behalf of his mother, but there's never anything that puts that argument in a legal box that the district court can then digest and apply, particularly in the directed verdict context. I mean, I agree with you. I've seen the complaint, I've seen the pleadings. And in the information that you've laid out in the reply brief, but if you don't ever put this assertion in a legal box, I guess it just feels like we're stepping into the role of counsel, and we're going to reverse a trial court decision to submit something to the jury when the trial court never had a chance to really properly understand the arguments that were being advanced.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree a little bit. And that is, I think this court's opinion, and I think you wrote one of them, and I think you were on the other two, said that the question is whether it's the substantive issue below was the same one that they were raising on appeal. And I think that Mr. Chase did that, and particularly did that in his trial brief and the argument on directed verdict, where he directly incorporated the trial brief. And if the court looks at page 15 of the trial brief, which I think is page 567 of the record, it says there, to the contrary, and this isn't specifically analyzing the wrongfulness part of the intentional interference claim. says, to the contrary, all the evidence shows that Mr. Chase only sought to assist his mother in the transaction and for her new home to be properly built. Their interests were aligned. This was particularly so after the failed closing, when Audrey placed Mr. Chase in charge of the negotiations regarding the transaction. Thus, any action he took was expressly authorized by her. He could not interfere. Mr. Chase was pursuing the interests of his mother at her directions. And so there could be no improper motive, so it's not wrongful. And here, on appeal, Mr. Chase is pointing this court to the agency law that makes that same exact point, that where one acts on behalf of another, their interests are aligned and there can be no wrongful interference. So at all times, Mr. Chase has taken the position that because he was aiding and assisting his mother and doing things on her behalf, his interests were aligned with her and they could not be wrongful. And to tie that in, I think, to Mr. Wing's first argument that there's the sole issue on appeal is whether or not the court made a finding. I think that that's a pretty restrictive of what the issue is on appeal. The issue on appeal is where there was this finding that Mr. Chase acted on his mother's behalf, and particularly up until the time of the failed closing, which is also what he was looking at with respect to the intentional interference with contract claim. What is then the legal implication that follows from that? And it is in fact true that Mr. Chase only cited to the district court other case law that dealt with whether or not, when interests are aligned, interference can be wrongful. And here, you know, just as in the 80 County Highway District, where there were statutes cited to show here's the statute of limitations, here we're pointing the court to the third authority that says, actually, not only is there the Silken case out there, but there is agency case law out there that says when you act on behalf of another, you're not a stranger to that contract, and therefore you can't have wrongful interference with that contract. And I think the court sort of saw that when he made the decision on the intentional interference with tortious interference with contract claim. And it may be perhaps we should have filed JNOV and done that. Perhaps we should have raised that other issue on appeal. But I think that goes back to the finding the court made there. It goes back to, or the statement the court made there, goes back exactly to whether or not the interference was wrongful. And where the court recognizes that Mr. Chase was acting on his mother's behalf, and there's not evidence to the contrary, then the legal conclusion that follows from that, whether the court follows Yoakum or follows agency case law, is you're not a stranger, you're acting for the benefit of the first party, there is not wrongful interference with the contract. And then you're right.
Ms. Olson, I understand your argument that essentially everybody understood this was an agency case, even though nobody used the word agency. That's my view. And I'm not saying that's necessarily an argument that I don't see. But if agency, if the so-called magic word had been used in this case, wouldn't the record look much different to us? If agency had actually been asserted, wouldn't there have been issues raised about apparent authority, implied authority, about whether the scope of the agency was this or that? But none of those kind of issues were discussed in that way, which makes me think maybe everyone didn't understand we were talking about agency.
Well, Your Honor, I think I don't think we're required to use those exact same words. Probably it would have been helpful if those words, exact words, had been used. I also think it would be a little unusual to say that your adult child is your, and use the exact word, agents. I mean, I don't think that my 86-year-old mother, who I take to doctor's appointments, thinks of me as her agent. I am her adult child who's helping her, because when you get to be that age, you need a little more help. And I think everybody understood that. And that's what the evidence in this case shows. Mr. Wing talked about the treasure trove of emails in which Mr. Chase, whether he was getting dictation from his mother or not, was acting on her behalf. And I do want to just point quickly in about 42 seconds, I can talk really fast, to the two other things he cites in his brief at page 7. And I would just ask the court to look at the actual record here. So this argument that she signed an addendum to move the closing date to July 19th, and then Mr. Chase sent an email saying we're not extending The moving it to July 17th, which didn't happen because people didn't sign it, was not an extension. It was a moving it up from a later date and to July 17th. That didn't happen. After that, there was a request to extend a later date, and that didn't happen. I would cite the court to look at those pages that he cites and also to look at tab 2, pages 332, say 6 to 21, where Ms. Hawkins makes that as well. And then also with respect...
I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off, but that blink light is blinking at us. So with that, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate your argument. For each counsel, this matter is now under advisement, and we will render a decision accordingly. We will now be in recess until October 4th, 2024, boys.
All
thank
right.
you again to all the hospitality we've seen here today.